live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how blueberries can help you from flossing. University of Laval in Quebec. Vitamin D, more research showing it can prevent cancer. Fast food intake increases your risk of diabetes and heart disease. University of Minnesota School of Public Health. Social deprivation has a measurable effect on brain growth. How low vitamin D levels has increased the risk of dying. Exercise can curb menopause and hot flashes and much more. Plus, today we're going to take a look at the level of threat when we don't eat enough fruits and vegetables, and now many governments are promoting a healthier diet. That's good, but their scientists are warning that climate change is reducing the ability to have abundant crops of fruits and vegetables. That's particularly true in Africa and the Middle East, but it's also true in the United States. In the near future, I'll be doing a trip from one end of California, the Mexican border, to the northern end of California. I'll be taking a special retrofitted RV where I can broadcast my shows daily, plus my film equipment so I can film. I'll be inviting people in California who want to come and see how this is done, where I'm showing the little tiny oases that are still surviving, but all of the impact of climate change on the soil, on people's lives. People thought they would never be adversely affected in gated communities, and there are thousands of those all over California. And it'll be I'm going to film it, edit it, and stream it right away just to show one state in the impact of climate change, but there are 20 states in the United States that are being impacted as well. Also today, GlaxoSmithKline, the pharmaceutical company, was fined on vaccine trials. 14 babies died, and they just had to pay a relatively small fine, not nearly $1 million. So what does it say about a corporation, their scientist, their boards of directors, and they're those in a position of responsibility, fiduciary responsibility, when they knowingly have dangerous products but figure, what the heck, so we have to pay a fine, but look how much money we make. It's a moral dilemma, and I'll talk about that. Also today, from Chris Hedges, from Truth Dig, the Graveyard Elite, I think you'll find that interesting. And we're going to look at other issues, including half of all American children are now living near the poverty level. This is according to the National Center for Children in Poverty. And this was done at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Why aren't any of the people in the media talking about this? We're talking about tens of millions of children who are at poverty level. What does that mean to them? Also, WikiLeaks had a document that shows the National Security Agency spied on world leaders on behalf of big oil. We had told you about this over 10 years ago, but we didn't have WikiLeaks. Now we have WikiLeaks. So they were eavesdropping in on private conversations of UN Chief Ban Ki-moon and German Chancellor Angela Merkel and other European politicians, and then they could turn that information over to people who run oil companies. Well, that's not right. That's not ethical. Yeah, but it's business as usual. So I'm also going to show you, when you think, well, how in the world could this many people be voting for the politicians in the Democrat and Republican parties if they simply knew the facts? There's an assumption they know the facts, or would understand what the facts mean if you gave it to them. What if they really don't know? So we're going to show you what happens when we have a camera going up to normal people, all type, younger people, college students, and we talk about when Russia nuked America. Well, of course, Russia never nuked America, but listen to their answers. And you think, whoa, and these are people voting? Then we're going to go to Flint, Michigan, and take a look at the water. Then we're going to, well, how about this for a tongue twister? Pathetic propaganda-peddling puppets are paid to push pernicious, pestiferous vaccines. Yeah. And we're going to show you who's behind the big push on vaccines. And also, our trade policies are a disaster. NAFTA, GATT, all of the World Trade Organization policies. So we should get out of all of them. There's only one politician, Jill Stein, who would revoke all of that. And there's one who's at least challenging it. That's Bernie Sanders. Good for him. We're going to play a clip. So we have a lot of interesting audio clips. As you see, we have a full show. So let's begin. First up, we want to take a look at vitamin D. Why? Because vitamin D is more than just a sunshine vitamin. It's also the vitamin that helps prevent depression. It helps protect us from heart disease. It helps prevent cancer. It helps build our immune system. It does so many wonderful things. Not hard to get if you get outside in the sun. But we don't. This is the latest. There's two separate studies. One done at the Moores Cancer Center at University of California, San Diego. And here's what it says. And the other is done at, it was published in the Journal of Asteroid Biochemistry and Molecular Biology. And the other is at St. George Hospital and Harvard's Nurses Study. Quote, two new studies on vitamin D using sophisticated forms of analysis called meta-analysis, in which data from multiple reports is combined, have revealed the preventing up to 50% of the cases of breast cancer and 2/3 of cancers of colorectal from vitamin D. Wow. That's terrific. Could you imagine one single nutrient that could do that? Quote, the data were very clear, showing that individuals in the groups with the lowest levels of vitamin D had the highest rates of breast cancer, and the breast cancer rates dropped as the vitamin D levels increased. So 50%, if that's all women had to do, and this is from five studies, so take your vitamin D to prevent breast cancer and colorectal cancer. We know that eating junk food is bad, this audience, but the rest of the world, not so much. This is from the University School of Minnesota and Public Health, and it says, fast food intake increases the risk of diabetes and heart disease. Quote, the dangers of fast food are well documented. The portions are often larger, and the food is generally high in calories and low in nutrients. Now, University of Minnesota's School of Public Health researchers have examined the eating habits of residents in Singapore and found new evidence that a diet heavy in fast food increases the risk of developing type 2 diabetes and coronary heart disease. The latest research by the American Heart Association's journal Circulation found that people who consume fast food even, this is the key, once a week. That means one day out of seven, if you have a fast food meal, quote, you increase your risk of dying from coronary heart disease by 20% in comparison to people who avoid fast food. People eating fast food 2 to 3 times a week, the risk increases by 50%, and the risk climbs to nearly 80% for people who consume fast food items 4 or more times a week. Wow, that is really serious. Now keep in mind that Singapore is a very sophisticated metropolitan city. It's considered the New York of the Far East, and they inherited our diet. They want the American diet. Now they get heart disease and diabetes with it. So that's staggering. So for all of you who thought, what's the big deal? So it's once or twice a week, I have some French fries, a cola, a hamburger, cheeseburger, fast food, you know, fried chicken. No big deal. Yeah, a big deal. You're going to die sooner. You're going to get heart disease and diabetes more often, big time. So I know that a lot of people in this audience will not eat junk food, but they want to share what they know with people in their family or friends who may. I did a long conference call last night, did two of them, totaling over 3.5 hours. And one was with a group of people who had been to previous health support groups. And I haven't been able to do a health support group in about 6 months because I'm on the road, and I am going to do another one this summer into the fall. Generally, they're 6 months. And our goal is to see, are people sticking with the protocols or not? What is changing for the better or worse in their lives? And how can we motivate people to stay with them? And the good news is that dozens of people are sticking with their protocols, some going back 25 years. And it's nice to hear when people tell you that they had diabetes, they had heart disease, they had skin cancer, they had a poor vision, and all that stuff's gone because they stuck with a healthy, organic, plant-based diet, exercise, stress management. And then you hear from people who say, well, when I was coming to the support groups every week, yeah, I felt a lot better and I did well. But then after a while, I kind of went back to my old ways. And one of the things that came out at one of the discussions last night, and this was a worldwide conference call, was social isolation. And I believe this is far more pernicious than what we would like to think. What happens when people are isolated? When they may, at this point in their life, that maybe they've gone through a divorce, a breakup, a death, it can really adversely affect you. I know for myself, when three of my best buddies growing up, one from the oldest friend I had from the age one, Tom Croft and I grew up together, and then one day they pass. And then you just want to take that time, and I do, and I don't do a thing. I just focus upon memorializing the best that relationship ever was, and you think about all the wonderful times, and you think, wow, that's gone now. It'll never happen again. Well, when you have enough of those people pass, that can create a sense of deprivation. Unless, of course, you're able to engage new friends, new relationships, and start new adventures, start new programs. And that's what we don't do so well in this country. We have tens of millions of people who had at one time friends, family, belonged to things, groups, guilds, sororities, fraternities, had jobs, and then one day they don't. And does that ever change your perception of your value? I'll give you a little story. When I first came to New York City, I worked over at the United Nations Institute of International Education. And then from there, I worked at a major retail outlet in junior management. And one day, I'd been there for 3 months, there were two older women who had been there for decades, and one of them had retired. And so there was an afternoon, after lunch, they had her a cake, and everybody wished her goodbye, and at the end of the day, she packed up, and, you know, she hugged the people that she'd been close friends with, and she left. Okay. Now, go through another 8 weeks, and one day, she comes back in, and she says hi, and there's only about six of us in this room. But her friend was there also, the one that she'd worked with for 40 years. And she goes over and she says, hi. And then you see this, well, I got to get back to my work. And the whole conversation took about 3 minutes. And you could see the person realizing that whatever she had in the way of that office friendship it was gone. You know, life goes forward, and she no longer was in alignment with the needs of the people in that office, though she had been for all the decades she was there. I remember feeling so sad for her. That experience really made me reflect upon the nature of business associations and relationships and personal ones and what happens when you no longer have that. And we're always going to go through changes in friendships and relationships in our lives. Though at the moment we're in it, we don't think about that. But when we're out of it, how many times have you thought about someone who's been in your life and for whatever reason, no blame, just they're not there, and you think, wow, boy, do I miss that. Okay. Now, do you stay in that, do I miss that, or do you revibrate and reconnect? So it brings me this whole idea that a lot of people didn't stick with their protocols because they felt isolated. They didn't have that support. And this came out very clearly last night. People who did stick with the protocols and those who did not. Now, there are other factors, of course, that are going to influence that, but that's a clear one. And one of the people I spoke with, she said that she is now a retired school teacher, and her life was so full when she was teaching, but now that she's not, she feels just this enormous void, and she tries to fill it by going places, but she doesn't have the same friends. The teachers who were friends of her every day, had lunch together, would talk. They're still in that life, and she did not make plans for a transition. In America, we're not good at transitions. There's no one there to guide us to say, okay, you're going through a divorce, you're going through a death, you're going through a separation, you're going through a breakup, you're going from employment to unemployment. Here's some suggestions that can help. We don't do that. As if by some form of magical osmosis, people are supposed to simply say, I got it. We don't. So we have tens of millions of lonely and then frequently moody or depressed people. And I believe that we should be doing much more socializing, getting out of our blue mood, and try to be around people that we can make new friends with. Who says you can't make new friends? And you don't have to have a relationship to have a friendship. And this historic notion that the only people you can associate with, people you're going to marry and have kids with, that's nonsense. We should expand our friendships and have friendships to go to plays with, who like cultural events and dancing. Just people who enjoy nature, going hiking. There's all kinds of ways that you can befriend yourself, and then you're no longer socially deprived. This is from researchers at the Labs of Cognitive Neuroscience at Boston's Children's Hospital, Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. So this is an important study. Social deprivation has a measurable effect on brain growth. And what this means is, in the larger vernacular, when you're not actively engaged in things that excite you, interest you, around people that you appreciate and enjoy being with, you have a decrease in gray matter, that's a bad thing, and white matter. So in effect, your brain chemistry changes for the worst. So keep that in mind, just as a suggestion, so that we can help ourselves and do things and get out there and live each day with balance, work and play. Also, from Vitamin D, European Journal of Clinical Nutrition, quote, low vitamin D levels, that's bad, linked to increased risk of dying, that's really bad. And this was at Oregon State University research. And the older you get, the more this applies to you. So we have to make sure that our parents and grandparents are taking at least 3,000 to 5,000 units of vitamin D every day. And they're getting about, half hour to 45 minutes of sunlight over at least their arms, legs. That would be important. And finally, exercise can help menopausal hot flashes. This is research at Penn State, and it talks about how the more you exercise, the lower your risk of hot flashes. And that's what they have written here. So I would say 5 days a week, 45 minutes to an hour of exercise, you lower your risk of hot flashes. Oh, and I mentioned blueberries. This is from University of Laval in Quebec. It says, quote, "Forget peppermint and spearmint. The best toothpaste flavor might be one with wild blueberries. Extracts from the berries might fight gum disease." And it goes on to talk about how many Americans have gum disease, but have found that there is a phytonutrient, a polyphenol, in blueberries that fights mouth-borne pathogens. How about that? This is brand new. I thought that was very interesting. So what I suggest is first people eat blueberries every day. And if you can't eat the blueberries, then have some blueberry juice or blueberry concentrate. And as more comes up on this, how it impacts the gums and the teeth, I'll share that with you. This was published in the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry. And it evidently has, quote, "It inhibits the growth of bacteria." This is the blueberries. "And it also blocked a molecular pathway involved in inflammation, a part of gum disease." So, turns off inflammation and blocks bacteria. Two good things, and that can help prevent gum disease, blueberries. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This was a report. It's GlaxoSmithKline, the pharmaceutical company. This is from Buenos Aires Herald. Quote, "GlaxoSmithKline, Argentina Laboratories Company, was fined 400,000 pesos by Judge Marcelo following a report issued by the National Administration of Medicine, Food and Technology for irregularities during lab vaccine trials conducted in the year 2007-2008 that allegedly killed 14 babies. Likewise, two doctors were fined 300,000 pesos each for irregularities during the studies. The charges include experimenting with human beings as well as falsifying parental authorization so babies could participate in the vaccine trials conducted in laboratories. Let's just put this in perspective. A pharmaceutical company engages in unethical behavior that leads to the alleged 14 babies dying. They're fined, and not a single thing happens to anybody. What are your thoughts on this? What should happen when companies engaged in unethical or illegal behavior that leads to death or injury? Your thoughts. Talk back. 888-874-4488. 888-874-4448. Excuse me. I'll give that number again. 888-874-4888. All right. I want to see your opinion on this. Now, here's another piece. In fact, I'm going to play an audio clip. I think you will appreciate this. This is dealing with vaccines. So listen in.
"Vaccines are linked to conditions like autism and ADD. Government officials and some scientists say there is no connection, and they're often backed by independent experts. But just how independent are they? You may be surprised at what Cheryl Atkinson found when she set out to follow the money.
Just waiting for it to come. They're some of the most trusted voices in the defense of vaccine safety. The American Academy of Pediatrics, Every Child by Two, and pediatrician Dr. Paul Offit. But CBS News has found these three have something more in common.
Polio number two.
Strong financial ties to the industry whose products they promote and defend. The vaccine industry gives millions to the Academy of Pediatrics for conferences, grants, medical education classes, even help pay to build their headquarters. The totals are kept secret, but public documents reveal bits and pieces. $342,000 was given to the Academy by Wyeth, maker of the pneumococcal vaccine, for a community grant program. $433,000 was contributed to the Academy by Merck, the same year the Academy endorsed Merck's HPV vaccine. Another top donor, Sanofi Aventis, maker of 17 vaccines, and a new 5-in-1 combo shot just added to the childhood vaccine schedule last month. Every Child by Two, a group that promotes early immunization for all children, admits the group takes money from the vaccine industry too, but wouldn't tell us how much. A spokesman told us there are simply no conflicts to be unearthed. But guess who has been listed as the group's treasurers? An official from Wyeth and a paid advisor to big pharmaceutical clients. Then there's Dr. Paul Offit, perhaps the most widely quoted defender of vaccine safety. He's gone so far as to say babies can theoretically tolerate, quote, 10,000 vaccines at once. This is how Offit described himself in a previous interview.
I'm the chief of infectious diseases at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and a professor of pediatrics at Penn's Medical School.
Dr. Offit was not willing to be interviewed on this subject, but like others in our investigation, he has strong industry ties. In fact, he's a vaccine industry insider. Dr. Offit holds a $1.5 million research chair at Children's Hospital funded by Merck. He holds the patent on an anti-diarrhea vaccine he developed with Merck, Rotatec, which has prevented thousands of hospitalizations in the U.S. And future royalties for the vaccine were just sold for $182 million cash. Dr. Offit's share of vaccine profits, unknown.
There's nothing illegal about the possible conflicts of interest, but as one member of Congress put it, money from the pharmaceutical industry can shape the practices of those who hold themselves out to be independent. The American Academy of Pediatrics, Every Child by Two, and Dr. Offit wouldn't agree to interviews, but all told us they're upfront about the money they receive, and it doesn't sway their opinions.
Today's immunization schedule now calls for kids to get 55 doses of vaccines by age 6. Ideally, it makes for a healthier society, but critics worry that industry ties could impact the advice given to the public about all those vaccines. Cheryl Atkinson, CBS News, Washington.
Now we're going to hear from Bernie Sanders on our trade policies and the disaster to American workers.
I think any objective analysis of our trade policies have shown that it has been a grotesque failure for ordinary Americans. Hard to calculate exactly, but I think it is fair to say that we have lost millions of decent paying jobs during the Bush years alone. Some 48,000 factories in this country shut down. We went from 19 million manufacturing jobs to 12 million manufacturing jobs.
NAFTA may be a good deal for the people who own our corporations, but it is a bad deal for American workers, for our family farmers, and it is bad for the environment. When multinational corporations throw American workers out on the street, and move to China, where workers are paid 15 cents an hour, where slave labor exists, where basic democratic rights are ignored, where workers cannot organize free trade unions. That scenario may be good for the profit margins of the large corporations, but it is a disaster for American workers.
Throwing American workers out on the street, moving to countries where people are paid pennies an hour, is bad public policy. It has failed.
And to continue that same unfettered free trade philosophy in terms of trade agreements with Korea, Panama, and Colombia makes absolutely no sense at all. That we are going to pass trade agreements which protect working families, which protect the middle class, which protect struggling people all over the world. We're going to vote no on Fast Track and no on the TPP.
Good. Now, this is at the same time that Hillary Clinton is saying, well, maybe we should consider modifying the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That won't happen. But behind the scenes, she was caught lying, out and out lying, according to Nation of Change. And I've seen the actual statements she has made that throughout the world. So, and this all came because of the getting the State Department actual transcripts. So on the one hand, she tells heads of government, yes, we're with you behind the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But to the American public, especially the unions that fawn over her, it's, of course we're for the unions. Bill and I have always been for unions. Yeah, just like you've been for black people. But you weren't. You did just the opposite. So let me read this, Nation of Change. Quote, Hillary Clinton caught lying to voters on trade deal. While publicly opposing an international free trade agreement, presidential candidate Hillary Clinton was secretly lobbying Democratic members of Congress to support the Trans-Pacific Partnership, as her newly released emails disclosed. Due to Clinton's history of dishonesty and political flip-flopping, Senator Bernie Sanders believes she will change her stance on Trans-Pacific Partnership and support the detrimental trade deal if she's elected president. In a press release from last month, Sanders' campaign wrote, quote, our trade, Sanders welcomes Clinton's newfound resistance to a proposal for a Pacific Rim trade deal, but notes that she was sympathetic to it in the past. And then it goes on to talk about how under Clinton and his policies, Bill Clinton and Obama, there's 60,000 U.S. factories have shut down. That's factories, not people. 60,000 factories. And it only will get worse. So we have all these statements of her emails showing that she supports it secretly. So that's who she is. Now, let's say hello to Matt from New York. Hi, Matt. You're on.
Gary, you know me. It's my aunt.
Oh,
M-A-A-T. Yes, right. Justice, Truth, and Right. Listen, I love your work, and I want to comment on the first question that might seem counterintuitive, but it's not really, as regards why those executives that work for the pharma vaccine companies don't wind up in jail. When this country, in the last 40 years, has built a prison industrial system around the black and brown folks in the U.S., where it affects their daily life. So, you know, if you live in a housing project, you trespass if you're taking out your garbage or in a different neighborhood. And I just see that we need to see how it's all connected. When you create the most brutish of prisons, you're not going to put the Hillary Clintons in there. Although when you think about that run she made on a bank they had set up in Iraq and things are coming out around, the Vincent Force, he was shot twice, you know, that's a strange suicide. And on, you know, unless, until we unravel, and you could give some very good information on that. This whole prison system, as Michelle Alexander says, the new Jim Crow, but it's actually the new slavery per the Constitution. The people who need to be in prison won't be there. And that's my comment.
Well, thank you. You've made a lot of comments. Let me just address one of them. The Clintons keep bragging, as do the corporate Democrats like the New York Times and others, about the economic achievements. But that's simply not true. If you're familiar with Jack Rasmus, who's a really brilliant researcher, historian, here's what he says. Let me read this. With every televised U.S. presidential debate, listeners are fed a line of bull by candidates about how great previous U.S. presidents were and how the country needs to return to their policies in order to make America great again. All that's needed, the Republican candidate says, to resurrect Reagan policies and today's U.S. problems will be solved. Vote for me, and I'll return to Reagan and restore U.S. greatness, we're told. With the Democrats, it's a bit more subtle, but the underlying message is the same. Under Hillary's hubby, Bill Clinton, in the 1990s, the U.S. created a record number of jobs, incomes were rising, the health care crisis was contained, and the U.S. had achieved a new economy of prosperity that would only improve further in the 21st century. Under Bill, we were on the right track. George Bush screwed it up by reversing course. All we need is to get back to that Clinton track and good times will return again. But what are the facts? Were Clinton policies a diversion from Reagan, a continuation, or worse? You first have to look at about the incomes. During Bill Clinton's two terms in office, 1992-2000, 45% of all income growth during the period went to the wealthiest 1% of families in the United States. That's according to the IRS data gathered by economist Emmanuel Saez of the University of California, Berkeley. The S&P 500 stock rose 234%. That provided the wealthiest 1% households most of the 45% gain. Bill's big tax cut handed to the 1% enabled that income growth by reducing capital gains substantially. In fact, under Bill Clinton, executives of corporations' pay rose an average from $4.5 million in 1992 to $11.1 million in 2000. That's a 342% increase. And CEO pay was equal to about 90 times the pay of the average paid worker. By the end, it was 300 times. So how did the average worker do over the same period? Adjusted for inflation in 1982, real dollars, average hour pay rose a paltry 5.8% over 8 years. That's over 8 years. That's not even 0.75% per year. Well, the cost of living rose far higher than that, so you lost money. You lost savings. At the bottom of the workforce, the minimum wage, measured in real terms, rose a mere 4% an hour to $5.50. The 5% increase and 4 cents an hour were more than offset. So you got 4 cents an hour increase. And that was offset by the workers' rising contributions to continue their pensions and health care insurance. And then the tax rip-offs and the jobs creation. Oh, okay. So the rich got significantly richer under Bill Clinton's watch. Yes. But at least U.S. workers were able to enjoy significant job creation, right? No. Hillary and the Democrats like to talk about all the jobs created in Bill's second term. Admittedly, jobs were created, but they were mostly in low-pay service occupations. Meanwhile, higher-paid manufacturing jobs are being lost in the millions as a result of Bill Clinton's free trade policies alone. Bill Clinton proved an even fiercer free trader than Reagan. In 1993, he rammed through Congress legislation to expand the North American Trade Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, to include Mexico. 1 million higher-paid U.S. manufacturing jobs were lost due to NAFTA on Clinton's watch. Another 880,000 jobs were lost to China due to Clinton's giving that country what is called preferred nation trading rights. And another 1.2 million jobs were lost due to U.S. exploding trade deficit in general. And that's according to Economic Policy Institute in collaboration with the Institute of U.S. Chamber of Commerce Department. In the 1990s, estimates that 13,000 jobs are lost for every $1 billion trade deficit, and that trade deficit rose to up $446 billion. Under Bill Clinton. And another problem with jobs during Bill Clinton's term in office was the rise in what is called contingent jobs, which means part-time temporary contracting and other alternative forms of employment that typically pay 60% of a full-time regular job. So you're losing 40%. Well, considering just part-time and temporary jobs, they're low-paid, they're tentative employment, and yeah, they rose from 22 million in 1995 to 27 million in 2000. In other words, when and if jobs were created on Bill Clinton's watch, they were low-paid and contingent jobs. And he destroyed welfare, putting millions of the poor out of work. So that's the takeaway message on that. I appreciate your call. Raymond from New Jersey. Hi, Raymond.
Yes, hi, Gary Noel. I love your show. I just wanted to comment. The first lady kind of basically took what I was going to say. I used to reside in the Bronx, and you can get locked up for not having public housing ID on you. And my rhetorical statement was, how is it that you can get locked up for not having a housing ID, but you can kill 14 babies and not get jailed with that? And I was going to say, why aren't they doing studies with, like, intravenous vitamin C of, like, buffered 5,000 milligrams and things like that, which work? Because I just had the flu, and I took 5,000 milligrams of vitamin C with protein, and I knocked it out within one day. And
Well, the money, you're right on a couple of issues here. Let's look at this. First of all, Raymond, you are correct. No one goes to jail in Big Pharma. That's tiny. 14 babies dead is small compared to, not to the parents, but to the 60,000 to 500,000 who died because of taking Vioxx. When they finally settled, they made $22 billion in sales. They settled for $5.85 billion and some more afterwards. The company stock rose. The head of the company got a promotion. So you kill more Americans with one drug in 4 years, Vioxx, than all of American deaths in Vietnam in 10 years. And your stock goes up, no one's held accountable, and everybody thinks this is great news. Now we can make more money. So you're absolutely right on there. And the reason why you don't see studies on vitamin C is because you can't patent it. And they're not going to put any money into anything that they cannot control the market of. I appreciate your insights, Raymond. And we have Walter back. Hi, Walter from Virginia. Where in Virginia do you live? Walter, are you there? No, we're having a problem getting him up? Okay. I'll take one more.
Sorry, Walter. Hello?
Did you go to sleep on us, Walter?
No, I didn't go to sleep. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now, yes.
Okay, great. I recently just listened to your podcast with Dr. Jill Stein of the Green Party, and regular listeners of PRN have probably heard you interview her in the past and are very familiar with her platform and policies. What I wasn't sure of and what I didn't hear was, how is she making the Green Party relevant to mainstream independents? Is there a lawsuit in place to get her on the ballot in more states? Is there a lawsuit in place to get her as part of the debates? You have talked in the past about a coalition of the various grassroots organizations that are independent coming together to form a coalition of one major independent party that we could all rally around. But what I wasn't hearing from Dr. Stein was what she's actually doing to push that forward, because it just appears that her candidacy is more or less just a part-time job.
It's not a part-time job. She's working 18-hour days. It may seem like that because you don't hear about her. You heard her say in the interview that she gave up all of her associations, her foundations, all of her other work to work full-time on this. The Green Party doesn't have a large fundraising mechanism. It cannot afford the ads. It doesn't have any of the PAC groups. It literally is word of mouth. My suggestion to Jill Stein was, and to Rocky Anderson, and to Ralph Nader, and to Chris Hedges and many other people, was all of the progressives come together, form an independent party, and then use the resources we have and the internet to make our message, even if we don't always get elected to an office, our message is kicking out and resonate. And I think that's important. Right now, what Jill Stein is doing more than anything is symbolic. And sometimes that can be extremely frustrating. Because if you say, why are you running? You're not going to get any real votes. Because you're not going to get the publicity. You're not allowed to go head-to-head with these people to show what a radical difference your program is. I asked her, will you close down all military bases around the world? She said, yes. Will you provide a single-payer health care? Yes. Will you get rid of the bad science at the CDC, FDA, and U.S. Public Health Service and fire all these people that are not civil servants and only allow those who have the public interest and say, yes. What she's doing is establishing a platform. what others have done is a platform. You have to have a platform that becomes an educational form to get it into younger people in high schools and colleges, and then use social media to promote those platforms. I'll give you an example. Let's say I do a documentary. I'm doing a new documentary now. It's called, I'll tell you one, the one I can't. But the one that I'll be premiering in the near future is called Manufacturing Madness. And in there, I show you that what we call mental illness simply does not exist. We have a lot of problems in our life. And I have ethicists, psychologists, psychiatrists, behavioralists, the best in the world, from all around the world, who will tell you, yeah, when people go through trauma or crisis or loss, they don't always come right out of it. No one has the same automatic, okay, it's 2 days and 24 hours, get out of your grieving, get back to normal, let's put on a happy face. It doesn't happen that way. But that is different than calling that mood you're in a brain chemical imbalance, justifying you being diagnosed, put into a system, and then given a series of drugs, none of which are going to change what caused the problem. All they can do is dull the reaction to it, where you look like a zombie walking around. It's like a person with terminal illness. Yeah, you can give them enough morphine where they don't feel the pain, but at that point where they have that much morphine and painkiller, they can't communicate. They're like, they're in a bubble. They can hear you, but they can't communicate with you. So it's not the best approach. So, but by putting that documentary out over a period of 1 or 2 or 3 years, if enough people on social media share it, and articles come from it, and discussions come from it, then at some point that can become a part of a political movement to stop pathologizing normal behavior, especially in children and infants. 600,000 babies will have a psychiatric drug given to them this year because they laugh and cry. That's considered bipolar. Sounds insane. To reasonable people, it is, but you're dealing with physicians, not reasonable, psychiatrists, completely not reasonable, medical industrial complex, they've never been reasonable, and the bureaucrats and technocrats that they control. You have to have a sustained educational program. One person running around in an election cannot do all that. So we have to allow the losses now to have the gains in the future. Better put your energy in building consensus with progressive minds on important issues and lay the foundation for a real educational program. That's what hasn't happened in the past. That's what we're hoping will happen in the future. I thank you for your call. From Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, nearly half of American children live near poverty line. I'll quote this. Nearly half of the children in the United States live dangerously close to the poverty line, according to new research from the National Center for Children in Poverty. And this illustrates the severity of economic instability and poverty conditions faced by more than 31 million children throughout the United States. Quote, these data challenge the prevailing beliefs that many still hold about what poverty looks like and which children in this country are most likely to be at risk. The fact is, despite the significant gains we've made in expanding nutrition and health insurance programs to reach the children most in need, millions of children are living in families still struggling to make ends meet in our low-growth, low-wage economy, end quote. Here are my thoughts on this. When you realize that 18 million children go to bed hungry, they're food insecure, that leads to multiple nutrient deficiencies, not the least of which is vitamin D deficiency. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, deficient in vitamin D can lead to early death and many diseases, including heart disease and also depression and brain conditions. And it's not that difficult to get children good health. My suggestion is we first recognize the problem. You cannot change what you're not willing to recognize. None of the people in the public office right now are talking about this. But they're also not taking you through America, the America that I travel through, to show you whole communities that are living at a subsistence level or less. I've interviewed so many senior citizens who are eating cat food because they can't afford regular tuna. And they're not getting their fruits and vegetables. So what do we do? Several things. First, we should start by having children's health centers established by the federal government and state governments in every single community in America. By doing that, you're then allowing families who have children who are not getting enough food to come in so they can get the help they need. Many of them need psychological help because what it means to be a child comes from a family that may have one parent and or two parents who are financially struggling, and that creates a social stigma. The child grows up many times feeling that they're of no value, and they look around them on television, and all it shows you is every program, every reality show is people who have abundance, and they have nothing by comparison. So they should have mental health programs, but not orthodox mental health that would put them on drugs. They don't need drugs. There's nothing wrong with their brain chemical balance. They need humanistic, holistic, psychological counseling. That's what they need. They also need in this center the ability to have some form of voucher where they can go to a store and buy healthy food. This is beyond food stamps I'm talking about, where they can get supplements. Because food is supposed to supply you with the vitamins and minerals and enzymes and nutrients you need, but it frequently doesn't. So there should be an educational program. There should be a dietitian or a nutritionist at each one of these centers that would guide people in how to make healthier choices. There should also be the capacity to have community gardens and have people work in community gardens, growing organic produce locally 12 months a year and using hydroponics in the winter months. So a person is no longer food insecure, but actually is learning about nutrition. And by the way, this is very common in Japan. In Japan, in fact, they actually have to take a class in how to make foods. And then you ought to see it. It's just remarkable. The kids all get up. They put on these outfits. They wash their hands. They disinfect their hands. They make the food. They serve the teachers and students and healthy foods. They'll have all kinds of really healthy items in their menu. American schools know. They give you junk. So if we were to have getting healthy, being sustainable, helping people at these centers learn skills that could give them employment or at least fair trade exchanges, carpentry, plumbing, electrical, masonry work, also things such as repairing, have a cooperative. They had this, by the way, in the 1930s, where if you broke a lamp instead of throwing it away or a radio, you would take it to a cooperative and people in that cooperative would fix it and then be able to sell it. And that's how a lot of people were able to sustain themselves during the Great Depression. We should have something similar to that today. We should even have farmers markets that are set up just for people who are financially struggling. That way you help the whole family. You give them a sense of purpose. You give them help. You give them tools. And I feel most Americans be only too happy to support this kind of effort because you're supporting the child, both physically with their nutrition they need and mentally and psychologically with behavior input, and you're helping the parents with career counseling. These are all things that matter. And if we did this, we would be doing a great service. So that's why it's important. So hopefully we will begin to do this. And if not, let us select a community that is impoverished. If anyone in this audience knows a community that is impoverished where they're willing to allow such a center to exist, I will bring in my resources, I'll fund it, and we'll build it, and we'll film it, and we'll show how much it can help the hundreds of people in that community, and the children in particular. And we'll do this for a year, and then take this film and the results and the individuals to Washington and say, why isn't this done in every community in America? So we can make a difference. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's show.